One, two, three, four.
What are the unseen challenges faced by diplomats, and what role do they play in maintaining global order? How do TV shows influence our understanding of real-world politics? How do women navigate power, and what does it take for them to lead in politics?
Deborah Kahn is the Emmy-nominated showrunner and executive producer of Netflix's The Diplomat, a political series starring Keri Russell and Rufus Sewell. She is also known for her work on Showtime's Homeland, ABC's medical drama Grey's Anatomy, HBO's Vinyl, and Aaron Sorkin's The West Wing, for which she and her team won an Emmy Award in 2003. Kahn is the winner of two Writers Guild of America Awards and the 2023 Quincy Award for Responsible Statecraft. This episode was recorded before the United States presidential election. It also contains spoilers for The Diplomat, so if you're not caught up, you may want to listen later.
Deborah Kahn, welcome back to The Creative Process.
It is so good to be here. It's good to see you again.
So in season one, you had Keri Russell as Kate Wyler. Just to recap for those who have perhaps not seen season one, or it's been a while since they saw it, Kate Wyler thrown into a role she hasn't asked for as a diplomat in the UK, this fish out of water story. Smart, wickedly funny, great writing, and matched with this incredible acting. And we see Keri Russell and finding her footing, familiarizing herself with what that entails, a lot of interpersonal drama revolving around her marriage on the rocks and the emergence of a love interest and, you know, everyone settling into the roles. Then we have this great cliffhanger at the end of season one where there was the bombing scene that blew apart her life and her world at that moment. At the beginning of season two, she's struggling to rebuild the lives that broke and the team that slid apart, and her worst fears unfold. And you describe that as the attack that brought her to the UK didn't come from a rival nation. It came from inside the British government. So in season two, you've reduced the amount of episodes from 8 to 6, and you really are ramping up the stakes with all this new political intrigue heightened. We're still learning who's good and who's bad as Kate comes into her own. All these things are thrown at her, and we see her realizing that sometimes diplomacy isn't enough or as simple as it seems.
That is all right on. The question of who's good and who's bad is always front of mind for me, because my basic goal is to get to the place where no one is good or bad. Everybody is in an unspeakably complicated situation. From the very beginning of the series, this event happens. We believe that it was perpetrated by Iran. And fairly quickly, we learn through the relationships that have been built over time between our heroes, Kate and Hal, and people in other countries, that the assumptions that we're making are completely incorrect. The people we assume have some sort of malintent toward us were working with a whole other set of motives, were being falsely accused. Someone else is sort of playing on the stereotypes we have of those people in order to send us off in the wrong direction. Much of the first season was this whodunit of, well, first you think it's Iran and then it's not. We then go to our next favorite villain in the world. We think it was Russia. It's not. And then we learn in this season that it was our closest friends, and that this terrible crime was perpetrated on British people by British people. So, you know, we think of it as the call was coming from inside the house.
The call is coming, and it's even coming from further inside the house. So you previously worked as a writer on the political thriller The West Wing, which featured Alison Janney as Claudia Jean Craig, another really strong actress. It was so interesting to see her in The Diplomat, now in the role of the U.S. vice president. So you've said that writing for Janney in The West Wing helped you establish your writing style. I'd love to see what you brought to this in terms of, now we're thinking about the election where Kamala Harris is on the ballot. You said you just voted today, and we're watching her come into her own, Keri Russell as Kate Wyler coming into her own, and it just feels like this fascinating story within a story that helps us understand what might be happening behind the scenes.
When I was first developing the series, Joe Biden was choosing a vice president, and a friend of mine worked in the political news business and said, well, he's going to pick one of these three people. And it was fairly early in the process. There was not a short list yet, and then there wasn't an even shorter list. And she said, well, no, it's one of these three. And I thought, well, there are thousands of people who could be writing for that job. And she said, no, there's three, and here's why. And she sort of ticked through this long list of what makes a person viable or not viable. And at the end of the list, I was like, oh my God, there's only three people who are close to getting this job. And probably one of them is a no, and there's really just two. So the idea that because of the number of things that we're looking for in a candidate for national office, the Venn diagram, you know, the spot that makes you viable at the center is so, so small. I was really taken with that and certainly fascinated with the question of the things that get you into the center of that Venn diagram. Are they the things that we want, or are we just ending up with the least bad option? Or, you know, in some cases, are we ending up with the most bad option because we're trying to move so far away from one attribute that we swing wildly toward another one?
Yeah, that's so interesting. And you'll correct me on the line, because at one point, Kerry Russell says that in diplomatic relationships, you form friendships with bad guys. And then you wonder, you know, are you just like becoming like one of the bad guys because of all of these negotiations and compromises you've had to make that you lose sight of what your goal is?
I think the thing that I'm trying to work with is the notion of most of the people we think are bad guys are in a situation with a set of motivations and goals and needs and restrictions that we don't understand. So the choice of bringing in Allison Janney was, I wanted to take somebody who we believe is a villain. Kate Wyler from the get-go thinks she's going to have a terrible relationship with the vice president, that this character, Grace Penn, is someone who won't like her, and Kate thinks she's evil. She thinks she's responsible for this massive crime that killed many, many people. And then once Grace brings her in to all of the issues that were swirling at the time that that decision was made, she very much is no longer a villain in Kate's eyes, but she's a model leader. She's exactly what Kate believes that the country needs. It's important to me to do that in the series because, particularly when we're talking about geopolitics and international relations, we often believe that we are dealing with enemies. You know, we call them enemies. We call them people who are out to get us, who despise our way of life, who don't love children, who have malice in their hearts. And it's crazy and bullshit. I certainly believe there are evil people in the world, but for the most part, it's really hard to get a country of X hundred million people and another country of X hundred million people to align with their goals and values and needs in a given moment. I think a lot of what we like to call ideological clash winds up being, you know, competition for natural resources. It's much easier to cast these battles in terms of good and evil than it is to recognize that the kind of questions that are being wrestled with by people who are dealing with global conflict are just so much bigger than we can possibly imagine or would ever want to.
Yes, that's why it's quite illuminating to watch these programs. Your research process gets behind the scenes. You know, I've seen you really do your research on this, but for others, we can only guess about these power plays. And so it helps, I think, shine a light, but there's so many gray areas to say. And then I've read analysis of your programs by people who contribute to foreign policy and things. And they say, oh, these things, I thought, oh, maybe this is hiding for drama. And they were outlining, oh, these things are really spot on. I could see that happening. And I thought, because it's written in a sort of Shakespearean way, I thought, oh, is this really real? I know. And the analysis was, yes, they're actually quite like that. So it's wonderful to see those vulnerabilities as well. And I wonder, you know, the audience for The Diplomat is not just in the United States and not just in the UK. So how do you find the responses are from different parts of the world, and how do you navigate as well? Because as you say, we all think in our own mind that we're doing the good thing, we're doing the good fight. But you talk about Iran or different countries, they have a whole different perspective on this. So what has that response been, and what is your responsibility to your international audience?
Well, most of the reaction that I get from people from other countries are diplomats from other countries. So it's not actually the question that you're asking, but we do get the response from diplomats across the world of thank you, now my parents understand what I do. But that the depiction in the show, there's a really great online newsletter called International Intrigue, which talks about foreign policy and the Foreign Service. And they, I think, very aptly described it as, our show is not realistic, but it is authentic. And that's really what we're going for as much as possible, is to kind of give people a window into what it's like to try to solve those problems, to do that work, and hopefully to understand what some of the motivations are of people on the other side of those arguments and what leads to these outcomes that, once they reach the front page of the newspaper, seem so outrageous or just kind of a very simplified cartoon version of what was actually happening in a room when people were trying to solve a problem.
Yes, it's interesting because a number of my friends actually are diplomats, or they're the children of diplomats. So it's so funny because they are not supposed to say, well, all the furious paddling that's going on under the water, they're supposed to be like calm, like a swan, I think.
Yes.
So it's nice that you do shine a light on this and all these disasters that are avoided through careful diplomacy or not. You know, we don't always make our way through. And I hadn't realized this about the actual diplomatic role of U.S. diplomats to the U.K., that it's kind of a pathway to the presidency.
In some ways, diplomacy is not a common path to national office in the U.S. because experience with domestic policy is considered more germane to those offices. That said, 5 U.S. presidents were ambassadors to the United Kingdom before they were president of the United States, which is just a ridiculously high number considering how many presidents we've had in all. So the U.K. is unique in that it's a very different country and it's a very different culture, but there are so many places where our paths cross as nations that the skill sets required to shepherd that alliance and hold higher office here are apparently not dissimilar.
Yes, and it's kind of a presidential role. So, I mean, let's go back to Kerry Russell's character. You know, balanced with all this intrigue, you show us a lot of her vulnerability. And today we live in a culture that encourages us to cover up our vulnerability, you know, at all costs. And so in this story, the central theme is that we try to avoid, in both life and fiction, to portray characters at their most fragile states for too long. We don't want to make them appear too weak, particularly in political office. But, you know, I really see it, and I see that in your storytelling, as a source of profound strength. It's our flaws that makes us uniquely human. And I think your characters are struggling to shield themselves from their, you know, kind of own humanity. Is kind of a powerful reflection on the tension we all face between embracing our imperfections as opposed to curating this image of perfection for the world. So it's kind of interesting to see also how a marriage can survive behind this veneer, within this diplomatic atmosphere, where also her husband, Hal, has to deal with going from being front and center to being behind the scenes. Again, kind of echoing what we're seeing now with the election and the exchange of power.
Those cracks in the veneer, to me, are the most fascinating and most endearing moments in any situation or in any person. And I'm a professional communicator, right? And I very rarely can get to the end of a sentence without losing my train of thought, doubling back 3 times, repeating myself, and then desperately hoping by the end of the thought, I'm going to sort of bring it around and make it sound like there was a purpose there. So that's the state that we're all in all the time. And I think it has a profound impact on important moments in our lives. I don't think events happen despite those cracks. I think they happen around and often guided by those cracks. So it's, to me, both important and just endlessly entertaining to see those moments and to give a little bit more of a spotlight to them.
Yes. And I think that it's so important, too, as you highlight, the what we think is the truth isn't always the truth. You're talking about, you know, seeing things from perspectives of other countries or other leaders. And so we can jump to a quick decision, but that might be wrong. So showing the meandering path, showing how we can get lost and we can have moments of clarity and fog I think it's really important to recognize our fallibility. And then also, as a reminder, a very important reminder, not to react too quickly, on whether it's geopolitically, whether it's on the home front with people you love in your relationships. There's always, I think this is so important, you show us, take a moment to imagine what it is behind their eyes, what they're going through and their struggles. So I love to see it played out.
There was a thing that I went to once. The CIA invited a bunch of writers for film and TV to come in and take a tour and learn about the various different capabilities that the CIA is working with, technologies that they're developing, what the work really looks like behind the scenes. And it was just mind-boggling how much knowledge and technological capacity they have and the different kinds of specializations people have. And then at the end of this really 8 hours of touring and talking to different people in different areas, we all had to leave and we had passes that opened the doors and the passes didn't work. So we had been there all day hearing about the great technology and then the special passes couldn't get us out the door. So for 20 minutes, 12 writers sat there watching the most capable and well-meaning people who are fighting for their country every day fail to get the gate to open, you know? So that, to me, is such a perfect moment of what it means to be a power in this world. There are certain ways in which we are an incredibly powerful country. There are certain ways in which our military is mighty and our intelligence services are unparalleled. But then when push comes to shove, you're still dealing with a piece of machinery that half the time doesn't work. I was listening to an interview this morning where a general was saying, you know, like, good luck finding a charging station in the middle of a battlefield. Like we are, I think, very much coming up against the limitations of, you know, what the digital technology that we've developed over the last 75 years in this country can do. We rely on it so heavily, but it doesn't work all the time. And I don't know, it makes me giggle.
Well, that's why we actually have to go back to, I think, what you highlight, these older skills, these interpersonal skills, the diplomacy skills. I mean, obviously, we're talking about technology and the war machinery. That's not the solution for everything. It's the face-to-face. I think, and you might have used this in other episodes or other series, those opportunities where the doors are closed and you kind of have to sit down and you can't communicate at a distance and you have to do that, you could come to great negotiations. So I'm wondering, you know, talking about the fallibility of technology, the fallibility of people, something that we're all considering now, you must be as a showrunner or a show creator thinking about how AI is becoming a pivotal force. You know, how do you see its impact on the arts and storytelling? I want to ask this as a kind of big question about how is it enhancing creativity? Or how do you navigate that? I know that you're very much telling these personal stories and it's not written by AI, but it's encroaching on certain elements like editing and different things. So how is it reshaping perhaps television or politics as we see it can have its effects on the election, democracy, production of journalism and news?
I toggle between being terrified about it and not worrying about it at all. I have not spent a lot of time playing with ChatGPT or Gemini or whatever they are. I don't want to know if it can write my show better than I can. And it's entirely possible maybe it can, but it's a brand new technology. We know it's going to change our lives and we don't have any idea how. And I very much am not looking to predict the way world-changing technology is going to unfold on a practical level in our lives. My father was a nuclear engineer. He built nuclear power plants, and he believed that he was creating a form of energy that would save the world, and it did not entirely go that way. But he had a little framed New Yorker cartoon on his desk of an old woman in a rocking chair looking up at a light bulb with like evil little waves coming down from it, like as if the light bulb was going to poison her. And that idea, the idea that when electricity, when the light bulb was first invented, it seemed threatening and it seemed like it would poison us and it seemed like it would be the enemy. I like to think that AI won't be. And I also definitely have the humility to say, I don't have the imagination to look forward and see how it will unfold. I think it's amazing to be alive when two of those sort of societal transitions are happening. You know, I lived through the internet's birth and kind of takeover of our lives. And I don't think anybody anticipated that it would become a shopping mall in the way it did. I think that I don't have the imagination and in a lot of ways don't want to have the imagination to try to see where this is going. I think it's very easy to spin out apocalyptic disaster scenarios, and I don't want to live my life that way. I hope it all works out. I hope that the computers don't win to obliterate us completely, but I also hope the planet doesn't burn. I think that we have to do what we can in the time that we're here to make the world safe and viable and meaningful for as many people as we can. And then we have to say, I'm going to pass this along to the next generation and know that they'll do their best.
Yes, definitely. I mean, when you talk about energy and the future, and that's like the possibility of a sixth extinction, I mean, I don't think about it in doomsday terms, but certainly I think that you are processing it through your stories. It has diplomatic implications, obviously, politically, of the dissemination of fake news and disinformation and these kind of things. Everything can be accelerated with AI, the good and the bad, and as well as you say, in terms of the environment and energy, accelerating our perhaps balancing our power grid. So it's interesting that your father was working with nuclear energy, which isn't all bad because there's the next generation nuclear, and that it's kind of a bridge. Well, I'm in France now, so we rely a lot on nuclear until we get to renewable. So it's a good bridge. It's not all bad. So what are your reflections, you know, just on the beauty and wonder of the natural world and why we need to make this green energy transition, but, you know, do you find inspiration from that? Just your general, like, reflections as you think about the planet and the next generation, the kind of world we're leaving the next generation.
I hope we're leaving the next generation a green and breathing planet. I think that there's still a lot of the world that is unspoiled and untouched and unmarred by our activity. Oh, I don't have a good answer for this question, Mia, because my mind always goes to the same places. You know, you emailed that you would be asking a question about kind of a moment of transcendence in nature. And the only one that kept coming back to my mind over and over was, I was filming in Virginia on homeland, and we were filming by a river. I had written a very, very long scene where two characters from different countries on opposite sides of a political divide having a long walk in the woods, which is such a sort of a profound idea, the notion that if we could just be together in nature and have a long conversation, we would come to an understanding. And the performances were beautiful, and the day was beautiful, and the trees, and in the river there were these big, beautiful stones that had been rounded by thousands of years of rushing water, and the tidal moment was such that I could walk out on these round rocks into the middle of the river such that the water was rushing all around me. And it was just breathtaking. And I recognized it as one of those moments of peak experience. And I actually called my boss and I said, I just want to thank you for giving me an opportunity to work in a creative field and to film a piece of television in a place as breathtakingly beautiful as this. And I'm having this sort of consonance of natural beauty and creative process and just really appreciating life in a sparkling way. And I want to thank you for that. And it was a lovely call. And I hung up and I went back to set. And everything had completely fallen apart. Filming had ground to a halt. Something had gone wrong that derailed the entire day. And I just couldn't help but laugh at the moment that I believed that I was in.
I think that's a great story because it's so funny because in the arts, we're often kind of trying to shine the light. Maybe it's on conflict and drama, but also beauty. And like Picasso said, you have to strangle the dove in order to paint it. And so sometimes you have to speed past the beauty in order to film the beauty. It's a practical element that people have to understand. And so you can't be looking out the window all the time. You have to also put your practical hat on. So I think that's important, that kind of balance. The pretty pictures at the end of the day are born by chaos. And that's what's happening in The Diplomat too. We think, oh, all this ceremony, all this, you know, at the very beginning in season one, it's like a kind of princess role. We don't say, but it's seen like that, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a Cinderella story.
But then all this stuff, as you say, honoring the teams behind it, the chaos behind it, the intelligence and just the quick thinking and the near misses. It's a real art, kind of like walking a tightrope. You know, I'm just wondering, of course, we're talking about the upcoming elections and how democracy we're seeing is very fragile, you know, and journalism is facing all these challenges on so many newspapers closing and the threats to the Fourth Estate. What do you think is the role of storytelling in preserving democratic ideals? And as you're navigating with The Diplomat, how do you feel the tension between like transparency and secrets, and also on the other hand of it, the necessity to maintain stability in government and media, I just seen with the release of Julian Assange, you know, so how do you see your role as a storyteller within all this?
I feel very fortunate that the medium that I'm in is television, which is a very long form of storytelling. You're not telling a single story, you're telling a world. You're inviting people into a world and asking them to live there with you, with these characters for a period of time. And to me, that's a gratifying thing because I can choose a world that I believe in, build it, and then not take care of it quite so much. When you're telling a singular story, you have a point that you're trying to make. Do you make it by the end of an hour and a half or not? There's a lot of pressure in that, and there's a lot of kind of desire to deliver a single message, perhaps if there was something philosophical or political or intellectual that you wanted to say. I find that I did all this research. I talked to such incredible people who do this work that's really about, you know, trying to end global conflict. And there are things that they've said that I think, oh my God, I want everybody to know this. I want to make sure the world hears this. And I have a platform and I must say this. Those things never make it in. They absolutely never make it into the story. I build a story around them, and then the scene where somebody says that incredibly profound thing gets cut, or the speech where they say that gets cut. The best that I can do is build a world where people are grappling with these kinds of important questions and trying to do their best. And I think all that I can expect of people and of myself is that we're trying to do something that is larger than ourselves. We're trying to achieve something that's not simply about our own selfish needs. And that's, you know, if we have freedom in our lives and any kind of power, be that communicative or financial or political or culturally, I think if our goals are a little bit larger than ourselves, then we're in the right arena. And then we can just, certainly with my characters, I can put them in that arena and then let them be and let them fail and let them struggle and not put them in a position where they have to teach us anything. I think our audiences are savvy and they don't want to be lectured by me. I don't want to be lectured by me either. And we all hear a lot of good information and wise information along with all the shit that we certainly ingest. And it doesn't necessarily change the way that the world unfolds. It's not just, oh, if we knew this one thing, it would all be different. For me, I'm really hoping to create a portrait of people who are working for their country. They're working for something larger than themselves. They're trying to do something to bring peace in the world. They could probably make more money doing something else. They could probably have more ease in their life doing something else. But they've decided to do this. And simply providing the example of that, I think, is powerful and meaningful, and I hope encourages some people to take steps like that in their own lives.
Exactly. It might not necessarily inspire everyone to become a diplomat in this case or work behind the scenes, but it gives them something to model about what it is to live with commitment and what it is to make mistakes, but also what it is to correct those mistakes and collaborate. I'm wondering how, you know, when you decided to create The Diplomat, you mentioned having worked on Homelands and The West Wing and other programs. I'm just wondering about how, what you've learned, you know, politically about the mechanisms of power and just how has it changed your worldview and your understanding of politics?
Talking to experts in the field, talking to politicians in this country on every end of the political spectrum, and talking to people in other countries, talking to people in the military and journalists and policymakers, I always came away feeling like I had encountered somebody who was really intelligent and had good values and was doing what they were doing because they were trying to make the world better for more people and for people that they didn't know. They didn't necessarily succeed. They didn't necessarily do that with a philosophical set of values that I shared, but I never walked away thinking, that's a bad guy. That's just a bad guy. And that was very much the driving force behind the creation of the show. You know, I don't happen to be meeting only the good ones. I'm meeting a cross-section that is not necessarily selected for any individual quality, and there are nice people who are working hard and basically selfless. So if that's the case, like, how do we get where we are? How is it that we have violent conflicts playing out in 15 different places in the world right now? It isn't because there's a better value system and a worse value system. It isn't because there's a right religion and a wrong religion. It is because it's really, really complicated.
Listening to Deborah Kahn in the aftermath of the United States presidential election, the idea that politics can't be reduced to a clash between good and evil feels hard to accept, even frustrating. It's far easier to assume that our political enemies, those whose goals and interests conflict with our own, are fundamentally bad. Add to this the doomsday language of today's political rhetoric, and politics very quickly spirals into a moral battleground. To think otherwise, we're often told, would be naive. This brings up a tough question. In a world where our political preferences are given moral weight, can we, as voters, avoid enlisting in a crusading war of good versus evil? Is there a way to understand political conflict and opposition without relying on moral binaries? As a master's student at LSE, I spent a lot of time reading political theorist Chantal Mouffe, who argues that politics is built on the distinction between us and them. But unlike today's moralized politics, this distinction isn't inherently about good and evil. Instead, us and them in this context are defined by conflicting interests, goals, and ways of life, not by moral categories. To set ourselves in opposition to someone politically amounts to saying, your worldview is at odds with mine, not your worldview is evil. Mouffe's us-them distinction offers another way to frame political conflict. Through it, conflict stops being a battle of moral absolutes played out by saints and villains, and instead becomes a space in which interest groups and communities confront and challenge one another on a public stage. Isn't this what democracy is all about? Isn't democracy a system designed to negotiate political differences through gritty debate, contestation, and public deliberation? Sure, it might not be a pretty picture, but as Kahn emphasizes, that's just politics. Through her work, we are reminded that politics unfolds in the messy, shifting spaces between individuals, between us and them, between Democrat and Republican, the US and the world. These differences can't be packaged away into good, bad, moral binaries, at least not if we want to recognize everyone's democratic right to debate in the political arena. While this might seem tempting at times, it also contradicts our democratic commitments. In the words of The West Wing's C.J. Craig, democracy requires that we accept that Brutus is an honorable man. This leaves us with one last question. For the sake of democracy, are we prepared to make room for all voices in the debate, even those we think hide a dagger under their cloaks? Or will we resign ourselves to viewing politics as a battleground of good versus evil? And now, back to the interview.
Indeed. And I want to ask you also, you know, what you were like as a young girl, as a young person. I understand with your kind of sense of empathy for these people in different positions that everyone, we have to remind ourselves, were once a child. And then they find themselves in these roles over time, or they inherit these belief systems once a child. And then they find themselves in these roles over time, or they inherit these belief systems on whichever side, whatever gray area they may be inhabiting, they have that. So I'm wondering, what were you like as a young person in your pathway towards the arts?
A couple things. I have a brother who's 10 years older and a sister who's 12 years older than I am. And I was the late baby in my family and in all of the extended family and the family friends. Everybody had kids. And then most of those families got a dog and my family got another baby. So I was not around a lot of kids. The kids were all teenagers and they seemed to me to be adults and I just wanted to be with them or like them. So I spent a lot of time quietly listening to the conversation of people who are much older than me. So I think that that gave me an ear for dialogue, and I think it gave me an ear for trying to follow along with things that I ultimately didn't understand, was dealing with as an outsider at that time because I was too young to understand what I was really hearing. But I think that that put me in a position to then start writing about stuff that I didn't really understand. I wasn't a political junkie who came to write about politics. I was a drama junkie who wound up on a show that talked about politics. So I had to learn a lot about something that I had no knowledge and experience of. And I think that turned into a skill that I found very useful to be able to go into a new world and say, so what does it sound like for the people who are really in here? How do they talk to each other? I don't want to have a character explaining something for the audience. I want the audience to believe that they're in this environment, they're really in this world, and that they're hearing how people talk to each other, and they're still able to follow as an audience. So I think that I'm always still sort of the little kid in the corner listening to somebody else's conversation. Also, certainly a large part of what got me where I am is both of my parents are immigrants. My dad is from Germany and he came to the United States, came to New York a year before World War II started. My mom was from Poland and she came a year after World War II ended. She was a hidden child in Poland and a lot of people risked their lives to take care of her. And I think I very much grew up with the idea that there were the good people and the bad people. And the bad people had tried to kill us and the good people either were us or were the ones that saved us. And I spent a lot of time trying to figure out what the difference was between those two sets of people. You know, they grew up in the same places, they lived on the same block. Like, why did the neighbors on this side of the house agree to take in and hide this child and the neighbors on the other side of the house didn't? And trying to be honest with myself about which one of those families I would be in that kind of situation. And wanting to not take the out of they were bad and bad people did this. Bad people murdered so many members of my family. I really want to understand the conditions that create that behavior. You know, I wish it was as simple as those people were bad and these people were good, but I don't think it is.
And that's why I think it's so important to understand this art of diplomacy, because now we see ourselves, whether we are American citizens or citizens of whichever country, and we're talking about, I have to mention, what's going on now in Gaza or what's going on in the Ukraine, where I would hope, I've always, people find this a bit controversial, where we would sue first for diplomatic solutions. And as hard as we could before we pursue those other options, you know, and it's very difficult because there's so much nuance in that, but that's my hope. And sometimes I feel not enough is done to avoid the conflict before it reaches the situation where it is now.
On the simplest level, I just want there to be more diplomats in the world. I want people to understand what the tools are, like what are the Legos that they're working with. I don't know who I'm quoting, somebody much wiser than me who said, you know, talking about the military, if the only tool that you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So if the only tool that you have is the military, everything looks like a conflict that can only be solved through violence. And I want people to know, what are the steps? What are the moves that we can make diplomatically? What are they doing in those rooms? And what makes a difference and what doesn't make a difference? Simply a greater understanding of those kind of technical logistical pieces hopefully give people a window into how that can go down. people who are doctors, their children are likely to be doctors. And part of that is a shared mission. And part of that is, you know what the day looks like. You know what the work is. It isn't miraculous. It's a series of steps. And I hope that more people can come out with a sense of, oh, I see what they're doing during the day. I see why we think it's a cocktail party and we think it's just a bunch of people getting dressed up and having idle chatter about the weather. What happens at the edges of those conversations about the weather? What happens in the hallway when everybody's having drinks? Like, what solutions can be found in those environments that can really move the needle?
Yes, we have to be less passive. And I really think you show us how we can have moral courage. And really, before that, just to inform ourselves, to go deeply, to understand not just the conflicts, but just what peace can look like, what a functioning democracy can look like. And what do we want when we talk about democracy and our ideals? So it really helps us reinforce that. And I know it's story first and then message, but I think that they are hand in hand. They're people, but they're also policies. So you mentioned your parents, you mentioned different collaborations you've had. If you think about mentors, teachers, collaborators, what have you learned from them? Who have been important to you? And what have they passed on?
I always think about having started my career on the West Wing and working with Aaron Sorkin and working with John Wells. John Wells took the show over when Aaron Sorkin left, and I had time with both. And those were very different approaches to the creative process. Sometimes I think of it like I started out working for Dionysus and then I went and worked for Apollo. And I feel fortunate to have had both of those streams of influence. Aaron was very diligent about putting story together that was based on realistic dynamics and true, detailed, intricate policy webs, but then also had the ability to just take a moment and throw magic at it. And a lot of those moments when you first talk about them in the writer's room seem silly or frivolous or not believable, but they are the moments that drag people into a story and grip them emotionally or imaginatively. And they're the moments that people remember. They're the moments that we enjoy the most in stories. And so how do you find the marriage between flights of fancy and realism? I started to gain an understanding of that process by watching Aaron go through it again and again and again. Working with John Wells, I think that I learned that in writing a television show, you're not working with a bunch of actors, you're not working with another handful of writers, you're working with 250 people. And 250 people who all chose to go into this creative field. And each of them wants to do the artistic, creative version of their job, whatever piece of the process that they're in. And there are situations as a showrunner that you can create that make it possible for all of them to exercise that creative impulse. And there are situations that you can create which make it impossible for anybody other than you to exercise that creative impulse. And most of that has to do with time. How quickly do you do your work? How quickly do you create a script so that you can hand it over to other people who can do what you did, which is spend time in the imaginative process of letting the story sort of live in them and germinate and see what comes out the other side. There are very, very simple steps that you can take to give all of those people a creative, artistic role in the process. And there are things that you can do that really kill that and kill it quickly and turn it into an exercise in frustration and kind of stifled creative impulses.
Thank you so much, Deborah Kahn, for helping us understand the art of diplomacy, leadership, and politics, and creating these dialogues for change and connection, and just showing us the commitment and dedication it takes to do something larger than ourselves. Thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
Well, thank you. It's always so great to talk to you. You really make me think hard about what I'm doing and why. Thank you.
You are covering a wide swath of intellectual and creative life. It's great.
The creative process is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producer and associate text editor on this episode was Virginia Moschetti. The creative process is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Katie Foster. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Natalis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you enjoy listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved in our creative community exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just drop us a line at team@creativeprocess.info. Thanks for listening.